Welcome to another episode of the Lookout Podcast. Today is a phone interview with the great Trina Moyles, who is author, adventurer, lookout, traveler, and outdoorsman. Outdoorsman? Right? Is that the unisex for that? Do you know Trina?
Outdoorswoman?
Outdoorswoman.
I'll take either.
Yeah, I'll do outdoorswoman. Yeah, that sounds good there. I was trying to figure it out before, but it was kind of early and dark in the old Airstream here, and I was like, I think outdoorsman, you know, like... struggling, but yeah, and you have, are you the author of two books at this point and working on a third? Am I right there? Or?
Hello.
Hey, Trina. I don't know what happened there. I think my service fell off.
Oh, okay. Oh, dang. Okay.
Yeah, it's very strange. Like, do you get that in Canada? Like in Montana, you'll just be like rolling along full service. I mean, like sitting somewhere full service, and then it'll just like the tower just quits on you or something. You're like, oh, okay.
Oh, yeah, constantly. The service is not great up here.
Oh, good, yeah.
But I think I'm just staying in one place, so I'm hoping that, like, my connection is okay.
Same, yeah, I'm just sitting here, and then, like, I'm even watching the bars as we're talking, going up and down. I'm like, what? Why? Yeah. I don't know. Hope it stays for us. Apologies if we get kicked off again.
Sure, yeah, no problem.
But, and I can edit the crap out of this thing, too, so it might sound a little rough, but, it, you know, I'll smooth it out through editing, but, when I was I was asking you about how many books you had, and you have Lookout and Women Who Dig at this point, and working on a third. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, you got it.
Awesome. And Women Who Dig is your first book?
Yeah, I wrote that in between 2013 and 2016, and I was like, actually before I came to Wildfire, I was working in international development. So I was working in a rural community in southwestern Uganda, actually, and I was really interested in food security and how women were involved in feeding their communities. Yeah. And so I began to interview women who I worked with there, and the project just sort of expanded out from there, and I ended up traveling to 8 different countries to interview women about what it means to grow food and, you know, steward the land. And so, yeah, I've always just really been interested in people who are working on the land and have like a close relationship with their environments. So yeah. So then from there, I began to work in the Fire Tower Lookout. So yeah.
Oh, yeah. Very cool. You kind of touched on it a little bit in Lookout, in your book Lookout. And I mean, the movement's going on probably forever, you know, like since the 60s about like being your own farmer and stuff, but it's just kind of, at least in Montana and probably parts of the US, it's been more of an issue in the last 5-10 years maybe. So like, you're kind of, you know, at least in my time frame, you know, where it was on my radar, you were definitely ahead of it for me, you know, and which I think is very cool, because it is important knowing where your food is coming from, especially with me having Crohn's. I really got to be careful what I put in my system, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was really interesting because I found that where women were working on the land, there was a really high percentage of those women who were growing organically, or you know, trying to mitigate the use of, say, like pesticides, or just like managing farms that were significantly smaller. Yeah. So just like more small, diverse systems, using sort of different strategies than like large scale agriculture would use.
Yeah.
So it's just like a really interesting trend there, actually.
Totally. And just a little bit of knowledge I have on it is just, you know, with those smaller scale operations, you can manage like things like, you know, weeds and pests much, much easier without any kind of chemical intervention. And like you said, you know, you get a better product. And like I said, too, which is real important to me and what I put in my system, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's funny because I think like a lot of what I learned from that book, like in doing the research, is I kept a big garden at my fire tower. So it's funny, like sometimes like the things you do seem like, you know, you're like all over the map, but I really like, I thought about that book a lot when I was out at the Lookout, and, you know, trying to like manage pests. And like, I remember like, I was trying to, I never successfully was able to grow any like cabbage crops out at my fire tower.
Yeah.
Like you just like, you'd plant them and then they'd germinate, and then you'd wake up the next day and they'd look like they had like teeny tiny little, like someone had fired like a teeny tiny shotgun at them. Like, and it's these flea beetles that like just like literally bite holes out of them. So there were a few things I never quite successfully figured out how to do at the lookout, but it was cool because the stories of the women that I interviewed really followed me to the garden at the fire tower.
Yeah, that's cool. And like bringing those memories with you and maybe it's just the way I was interpreting the book, but I thought you did a great job of bringing all your past like history and experience to the tower and then lacing it through the book, interlacing it through the book in ways like that with the garden. And I was like, man, that's cool. Cause for me, for a book to be something that I enjoy and would recommend to somebody else is one that takes you on a journey and one that you immerse into and you really feel like you're living the story along with the author. And I definitely got that out of your book and it was very well written, I thought.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. It's funny when I thought about like what kind of fire tower book I wanted to write. And, you know, like we were talking about this earlier, but like the interesting thing about firework is it draws all sorts of different people together in the season to fight fires for this like common purpose, but we all have such different backgrounds. Yeah. And there's, you know, like there's sort of that hurry up and wait period in fire. So like, there's a lot of space to fill when you're out there waiting for something to happen, or like when you're out at the lookout, it's just you, you know, and in my case, I had my dogs too, but like there's a lot of ruminating on the past, you know, and I didn't want to pretend otherwise. I was like, you know, a large part about being out at the tower is thinking about your life because you have this enormity of space. And so I did kind of want to pay homage to those, like the things I was thinking about, especially in those first seasons, as I was like transitioning away from this like totally different lifestyle, and being out there. I actually just chatted with someone who's interested to apply to be a lookout yesterday, and she said, she was like, oh, like you know, what did you do out there? And I'm like, I don't know, I think you really like think a lot out there. So yeah. I wanted to bring those memories into the book because I think that's a really honest part of being a lookout. And then like sometimes also like the things you think about in your past like can also work against you too, so you really had to like you know, figure out how to like manage what you're thinking about and make sure that it's not interfering with you being alone in the bush and doing your job.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, you know, like the title, you know, like please correct me if I get this wrong, I meant to bring the book in with me and I totally forgot, but Lookout, Love, Solitude, and Searching for Fires in the Boreal Forest, in the Wildfire.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah, and like, so that solitude part, yeah, like it really hit home with me. Because like you said, any aspect of fire, you're going to be at some point in the middle of nowhere, typically, and especially as a smoke jumper and a lookout, like in the middle of nowhere, just maybe watching something burn. And like as a smoke jumper, you'd be pretty much have it put to bed, but it'd be so big that you're just kind of letting it put itself out a little bit, managing the edges and working your way in, you know, like every day you go a little more interior until you got all the smokes out and you feel comfortable leaving it. But there's a lot of downtime. We're just kind of hanging out. And, you know, like you said, and even if you're still like digging, you're typically by yourself, especially as smoke jumpers, you spread out. So it's like, I really resonated with that part of the book too, is like your brain can wander on you. And like you said, if you don't kind of rein some things in, you might beat yourself up about something embarrassing years ago that doesn't even matter anymore. But you're like, oh man, I'm an idiot, you know, like I'll just be out there digging, like beating myself up. I'm like, it doesn't matter. You know, it wasn't that big a deal, but, or then a lot of times for me too, I'd start like do some future planning. And, I got to be on quite a few of those fires and they're pretty cool. But I remember one particular, I was on this ridge, in Northern Idaho, somewhere near, Lake Ponderay and, north of, Coeur d'Alene there. And I was like just like looking out, and I was the IC, so I was just kind of sitting on top and just talking to dispatch, and the only spot I could really get any kind of radio signal. And had a little time to think there while I was filling out all the paperwork for it. And I was like, man, I feel like I could be doing something a little fun, a little bit better with my time right now. You know, like I'm sitting here and I got, you know, family and friends, you know, out, you know, getting married and doing other stuff. So that was kind of like what started me, the transition for me, which I think is healthy, because if you know, if I would have got my tumor, like I was telling you earlier, and my Crohn's going bananas, which ended up happening like a year later, if it would have been like sudden like that, I, you know, might have had some regrets and been a little sad that I got forced out of fire, but I'd already kind of had the ball rolling in my head, you know? So like when, illness and everything started piling on and I couldn't do the job anymore, I was already kind of accepting it, I guess.
Yeah, I feel that so much. Like in my last season at the Tower was 2022, and my brother passed away early in that season. And you know, like I talked to other lookouts about what that would be like, you know, to be out in the bush and to experience the death of a family member or a loved one, and like, and how you would process that, and like, you know, would you continue with your work? And for me, I think like when you experience a death, it's such a shock. And like in his death came out of nowhere. So it was really, you know, it was really shocking. Yeah. But my immediate instinct was like, I wanted to go back to the Tower because that's what I was familiar with. Yeah. And so I did finish out the season and I'm glad I did. But I think really that's for me that season, things started to shift in my mind where I was like, maybe it's time to do something else. Like maybe it's you know, like, I loved Fire Tower so much. I think that's like obvious in the, you know, in the book.
Totally.
And it's like, but it's hard because it's like, you know, it becomes your community, it becomes your family. And so transitioning away from that can be a really difficult decision to make. Yeah. But, you know, I think, yeah, I was just ready for other, I think other experiences, but in some ways I still feel like I'm a lookout, you know, like all the things I learned out there in terms of observation and noticing things in the forest, like I still apply that now, even though I'm like not reporting it to anyone, but still feel like my mindset is very much like I see the world through this fire lens. And I'm sure that's the same for you too, and for like lots of people who work in it and then wind up transitioning into other kind of work or other, you know, lifestyle. Like Absolutely. It really stays in you. And it's just a part of my life I'm really glad I got to experience.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I totally feel the same way. Like, I'm still kind of looking for smokes along the horizon, you know, because, like, as fire folks, we're all trained to look for smokes, you know, and because even if, you know, like, say, for example, you were the lookout calling a smoke, and a little different around here because we have roads everywhere, but, you know, we'd be talking to you and scan the same horizon and the same patch of trees and being like, all right, yeah, I see what you're looking at, you know, and trying to figure out, like, if it's a smoke or, you know, or its location, you know, like, because... As you know, like once you've been a lookout for a while, you really get a good eye for it. And so it's like, I'd never question a lookout. I'd be like, all right, yeah, I kind of see what you're looking at, but I want to get a little bit more smoke or something so I get a better bearing before I barrel in the woods, you know, blind.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, and I was going to say too, like tacking on to kind of, you know, like having the time by yourself to process a few things, like it seems like as, you know, our ancient ancestors, you know, we're better about, you know, like mourning periods and giving ourselves better time to process, where today it's like the hustle and bustle. So I think that was, you know, in my opinion, was a great move. And I was going to mention that earlier about just like the, you know, the lows that you went through in your life and really big challenges and how you're able to navigate it. And, you know, mental health for a lot of folks is, you know, big issue, especially fire folks, you know, like it's constantly talked about, especially in the fall when the season's over, you know, everyone's always worried about their brothers and sisters in fire because you're like, man, how's everybody doing? You know, cause like the off season could be pretty rough, you know? So like I don't know what you think about that, I guess, with the being able to process a little bit more. You think that's an accurate statement or am I off the wall here, I guess?
No, I think that's really, like, I actually wrote an article with another journalist named Jesse Winter for the Narwhal last, it would have come out last September, and it was looking at mental health crisis. And I think we can call it a crisis among firefighters and wildfire personnel. I think it's just been something that's really, like, it's talked about within the sector, but I think a lot of people outside of it don't realize that it really has been, and not just like because the last fire season was so intense, it's actually something that's been going on for a very long time. And I think for me, I always felt like it was different because I didn't have the tight camaraderie that firefighters would have had, because, you know, you're kind of like living, eating, breathing time with this crew, right?
Yeah.
But I still did feel really connected to a community out there, like the voices of people you hear on the radio, you know, the pilots, the crews that do come out now and then to like day base at your tower and stuff, like you really do feel a part of something. And there's this like intense common purpose. Yeah. And then when you get your, you know, in Alberta, we call it the termination letter. You get your termination letter, you know, and you know, you'll be back on next season, but it's sort of like, okay, the season's over. And then everybody just disperses and it's like, okay, now what, you know? And I always kind of struggled with that transition back into, not just back into society, because like some things were easier, you know, like coming back into society, you got like running water, you know, it's like you can see people when you want to see people.
Yeah.
But like without that sense of like common purpose, I sometimes felt a little bit like I was floating in my off season.
Yeah.
Like what am I doing? You know, like, you know, who are my people? And like, and yeah, it's tough because like a lot of your other friends and family are, you know, like life is continuing and they have families or they, you know, just made different choices. Like they have a little bit more maybe stability. I don't know if that's the right word, but yeah. I always found that a little bit challenging to navigate. And then, yeah, the story that Jesse and I did, like, so it's something I was always aware of, but then it's funny when I put my journalist hat on and I started asking people more pointed questions about it, I realized like, this is actually really serious. Like this is, you know, and people are, you know, a little bit vulnerable, I think, in the off season.
Totally.
Of like, especially, you know, like sometimes we make healthier coping strategies or decisions, you know, than other times, you know, and so I think for people to like, you know, maybe hit the booze a little bit harder than they would otherwise, or,
yeah.
You know, like just like lacking that crew support because everybody's off doing their own thing. So I think it's easy for like loneliness to creep in and maybe like a little bit of that, like, oh my God, what am I doing with my life? You know,
yeah.
That kind of feeling. So it's hopefully I think like the agencies are becoming more aware of it and like more supports can be put in place. Like I know even in Alberta, like it's like as soon as you're terminated, you don't have access to any of the mental health supports. Well, that's ridiculous because you know you're going to be, you know, like the whole point of the seasonal like worker thing is like these people being pretty vulnerable because they don't have those supports in the off season. So
yeah.
Anyways, I think I'm rambling, but it is a really important thing we should be talking about for sure.
Yeah, no, you weren't rambling at all. You're hitting all the good points because like I said, it's so important. I think you were accurate in calling it a crisis too. It is. And I mean, we're losing fire folks every year, you know, it's not like it's a once in a while thing. It's all the time. You know, you hear about somebody who decide they're going to end it in the off season. You're like, oh man, like in.
Yeah, I think like the suicide rate.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, the suicide rate amongst wildland firefighters is quite high compared to other sectors. So it really is a thing. And you know, it's crazy because like in my last season, like people don't think of like lookouts as having PTSD, but there's different psychological challenges out there. A, like the isolation is very difficult in itself.
Yeah.
But I remember I had this moment, and this is sort of like one of my moments too, where I was like, I think I need to take a break from this, you know, like maybe one day I'll go back to it, but like, I need a little break from it right now, just because it was such an intense summer for me. But I was up and I mean, it was a cool moment because I had spotted this little, just like, it always like, you know, the big fires would pop up and you call them in. Mm-hmm. But to me, it was like more rewarding if you could spot something that was really tiny, because, you know, you're just like challenging your eye, really, like, is that a smoke, you know?
Definitely,
and
yeah.
This is like teeny tiny little tuft popped up over a ridge, and like to me it was always color, like that's how I could identify. I was like, yeah, that's a smoke, you know, it's got that like little like bluish tinge to it.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was so tiny, it was probably like 30 kilometers in the distance and just coming up over a ridge.
Damn.
So I called it in the crew, and like by this point, you know, I'm 7 years in, I know the crew leader, I know the pilot, these are friends of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And they fly out to go like check it out, and sure enough, it's a wildfire. And I felt like, you know, I felt really boss. I was like, yes.
Yeah.
So tiny. And and so they drop the crew off to action, and then the pilot's got a bucket on it, and it was weird because I was watching him through like the spotting scope up in the tower. You know, they were that far away.
Dang.
And it's just like the way he was flying, but like for a split second, I felt myself panic and I was like, oh my God, it looked like he was crashing. He was really just flying downslope,
yeah.
You know, but it was that moment where I was like, I literally thought my friend was about to crash. And then I realized like, what is this? And I was like, I feel like this is PTSD. You know, it's like my adrenaline was so high and it was like, you know, kind of clouding my judgment. And suddenly like the fear brain was just like totally activated.
Yeah.
And it just reminded me, I was like, whoa, like, you know, I climbed down that night and I was like, okay, I think I'm like, I don't know if that was my moment, but I was like, I need a break from this because like, you know, it was just feeling too intense, you know?
Totally.
Yeah, it just, you know, sometimes you surprise yourself in things you think and you're like, whoa, where did that come from? You know?
Yeah. No, and I had a very similar experience because my rookie season, I was working with a parajumper from the military, and he was just kind of talking about the stats on helicopter crashes and injuries under parachute, and he had so many jumps, and you know, kind of what the odds are, like, you know, generalization of what the odds are to be in a helicopter crash or to, you know, pile in under a parachute. And I was like, you know, at the time I was a young kid kind of, and I was like, yeah, yeah, I guess, you know, and I was just like willing to take the risk. But I had the same thing where it just like felt like that kept creeping in. And then, as you know, in fire, it's like people, you know, you start to know more and more people every year, you interact with more folks in the fire world, and then, you know, every year someone's getting injured, killed, whatever's happening in the line of duty. And it's more of a, and it's definitely a win, not a if, you know, somebody who gets injured or killed, or maybe it happens to you, I guess. But for me, I felt like that bubble was closing in on me, because it felt like I was getting, you know, closer to more tragedy fires, and like, eh, I don't like this, you know?
Yeah, it's real. And I mean, like, look at last season. I think last season was one of the highest fatality, like, of people on the line in Canada. Like, I don't know if that's for sure, but like, I think it was, I'm trying to remember, I think it was at least 8 people that died on the fire line in Alberta. And one of those, yeah, was a helicopter crash. And actually it was a helicopter crash in my home district in the Peace River Country, you know, and like my friends like heard the, you know, like the distress call on the radio and stuff, and, or, you know, or were the dispatchers having to respond to it, like, or the ranger showing up to have to respond to it. So it's like, it's real.
Yeah.
And I think that's important for the public to know that, you know, like the climate crisis and these wildfires, like it has a huge social and sort of psychological toll on the frontline workers. And I think they tend to be a little bit forgotten about because so many wildfire fighters are seasonal. And again, they're kind of lacking some of those benefits. So I think it's really important that governments kind of relook at like, how can they better support people who are taking on this work that is like, it's really risky work, right?
Yeah.
And it just hasn't gotten the same attention, I think, that other professions have gotten.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's like a you know, it's compounding stress that unless there's a way to mitigate it or decompress, it's just going to keep building, like me and you experienced. And I'm sure most people in the wildfire world, and well, just fire in general, any kind of fire probably, or any kind of service, I guess, first responder service, probably all feel, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I really feel I still think about the fire tower a lot, and I still think about, you know, my friends who are out there on the line and stuff, and
yeah,
it really bonds you, you know, I think it really bonds you together. But I also, like, now that I'm on the outside of it, I'm like, I really do believe that, like, some stuff needs to change in terms of policy to, like, to better protect people, because, like, yeah, like, when you're in it, you know, no one's supporting you more than, like, just your peers and, like, the people around you,
totally.
And that's an amazing feeling. But also, like, I do feel like the government has a role to play in better protecting and supporting people out there, and, you know, or even just, like, you know, allowing more time for decompression, because it is such a thing, you know. So there are some shifts, I think, that need to be made. Now I'm on my soapbox.
No. I think, yeah, like, you know, down here and, you know, this subject has been in and out of my podcast quite a bit, because, you know, some of my friends were in the hotshot crews. We've talked about that, and especially, as you know, on the cruise, well, everywhere really, but on the cruise especially, it's like 100 miles an hour to zero, you know, like all of a sudden you're like you said,
yeah.
the termination letter, and at the jump bases, we always call it the tea party, or we'd have the tea party at the end of the year. And I think that helps everybody send off, because like you get terminated, the party's like somewhere close to that time period, either like right before you get laid off or around the same time. So you got this big like event that happens where everybody gets together and you talk about the season and just enjoy each other's company and make some plans. And I think that really helps, you know, and not everybody does it though.
Yeah. I think that debriefing is really important for sure. And I mean, it was trickier at first as a lookout because you weren't really sure who to debrief with. But I mean, you know, I'll say like the power of social media, like to be able to find other lookouts. And I think in my third season, I went on Instagram and I started to realize like, oh man, I was like, cause I was in like a district with quite a few lifers. So like most folks were quite a bit older than me. And then going on Instagram, I was like, oh man, there's other folks who are like in their, you know, 20s, 30s, 40s and, you know, online and stuff and kind of posting about their experience. And that was kind of a bonding opportunity for me to make those connections and just like really start to feel like, oh, I'm not alone in this, you know, like, but yeah, I think the debriefing is really, really important.
Absolutely.
Even sometimes I wish there was more debriefing between like lookouts and crews, and you know, because like sometimes like, you know, like we get a little siloed in our own role in forestry too, and so and which can also be like hilarious. It's like, oh, why did dispatch do that? Or like, how dare the crew fly into my area and not ask me if I had any active permits burning? You know, like that was always a big thing in our district.
Totally.
And
yeah.
Usually be like a rookie crew leader who just like forgot, you know, but
we got the same things going on. And, you know, we were trying to get the districts to send folks to the dispatch, you know, to get, even if it's just a couple weeks, to see what happens on that side of the curtain. Cause like you said, it's so easy to get disconnected and start getting grumpy with somebody else that's like on your team. You're like, get, you know, go spend some time there. And I think, like I said, the debriefing with the lookouts too is important, because I guarantee if I was on that fire that you spotted that was 30 kilometers off and just a wisp, I'd have been like, Trina, way to go. Let me buy you a drink, because that was incredible, you know? But like, you don't really get that interaction.
And I should say, like, at that point too, like, I think I got like a few messages from people being like, whoa, like, I never would have seen that. I flew over that. I have no idea how you saw that from so far away.
Yeah.
So like, they'd be really validating by the end for sure. Like it was, and that was the special part, I think. And the hard part about leaving after 7 years was like, you just felt like such intense camaraderie with people. And like, again, that would surprise people, because it's like, well, you're out in a lookout, you work alone, you know? And it's like, yeah, but you just really felt like, you know, you're part of a family. And I still feel that way now. Like I really sincerely miss people in their days. I really miss like those interactions and stuff. It's a really special thing for sure.
Totally. Yeah. It's important, you know, like everyone really cares about each other, and everyone has such a vital role in the whole fire world. And it's such a tight community, and it's not just like coworkers, you know, it's like family, like you said. And then like you kind of touched on earlier too, like once you're a fire person, you're always a fire person, because that experience stays with you and those memories. And I kind of had that too with one of my really good buddies, Matt Mai, who's jumping out of Missoula. He knew I was on my way out. We were down south, you know, somewhere in like Arkansas or, you know, Texas or something. I can't remember where. And we were just walking the line, and he's like, you know, I was just bouncing some things off him. And I didn't say anything really about leaving, but he's like, he brought it up. He's like, hey man, you know, like once you're a smoke jumper, you're always a smoke jumper. Like people can't take that experience away. So it's like, you know, and I can't remember where he was going with it, but I was like, oh, that's a good point. You know, and kind of, you know, same with you, you know, once you're a lookout, you're always a lookout, and you can always go back whenever, you know, like for a retirement gig or something, you know?
Yeah, I know. That's what people tease me about. Well, like it's funny, cause I live up in the Yukon Territory now, and I believe there's 7 active fire towers. So I did think even the summer, I was like, well, maybe I'll put my name in the hat just to do relief work, you know, and like go out for like a week or two. I think I could handle that. So yeah, I'm not going to count it out entirely. It's obviously, you know, it's like something that's in you, and,
totally.
And it is, it's a pretty, pretty unique thing. And, yeah, I just, I love it. And it's funny, cause last summer was my first summer away from fire. And of course it was a weird experience, cause like 2023 was a crazy season in Alberta. So like my friends was like, you know, my friends were getting evacuated. They were like next to these like, you know, rager fuck off fires, like just, you know, it was a wild season, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of strange to be away from that when like people were going through something like quite traumatic and like quite, you know, like just a, you know, unforgettable season. I'll say that, maybe not traumatic, but like unforgettable for people.
I think both apply. Unforgettable and traumatic.
What's that?
I said, I think both apply there, like unforgettable and traumatic, you know, like.
Yeah, it probably was traumatic, you know, and actually I know it was. Sometimes that word seems so harsh, but yeah, I think really it was, you know. I had friends who like, you know, were up and they had like, they watched like communities get burnt over, you know, and like that's devastating. So yeah, traumatic is definitely the right word.
Totally.
And yeah, for me, it was weird to be away from all that and feel kind of like, you know, a bit helpless, to be honest, like where it's like, well, what do? You know, like you're here, I am like going on my hikes and stuff and like things that I'd wanted to do for so many years. And I did enjoy it, but there was this part of me that was like, yeah, but I'm still in the lookout, you know, and,
totally.
and maybe feeling a little bit of like guilt, even though like they didn't need me out there. There was like, you know, I was replaced, like there's someone else out there, obviously. But just sort of feeling maybe guilt from stepping away from it all. Like that was a little bit tricky to navigate.
Yeah.
But I did get to see one beautiful, because like the territory is so vast up here. So a lot of the fires, they do just let burn because they're not even close to communities. and obviously the forest does need to burn. Yeah. But yeah, I was out camping with my partner, and we were out on the lake, and I was like, oh, look, that's a fire. And it was just like creeping up over a ridge. And then we literally watched it for the next 2 hours, like just like blow up. And it was, to me, I was just like, I think I had a big grin on my face. I was so happy. I was like, oh, look at that beautiful, smoke column.
Yeah. Oh man. Yeah. I've had a few of those little moments, but not quite as good as that. Cause I was talking to one of my friends who was a hotshot forever, and he's still on fire, but we were just talking about the day where you just are sitting on your tailgate with, you know, a beer or something and just able to watch something just like, you know, take a run and not have to think about like, oh man, I got to go engage. And, you know, like this is going to eat my life for the next couple weeks, you know? And like you said, a lot of it does need to burn, you know, as long as it's not like impacting any communities, it's just kind of like you're hoping it just does its thing for a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
Man. Well, I was going to ask you a few other questions if you got time. I don't want to keep you too long.
Yeah, for sure.
So being up in the tower, you know, we talked about it quite a bit, but like, I guess like one last thing on what we were talking about earlier is like, kind of the robotic, vision. I think sometimes the public sees of fire folks, you know, because it's just like almost like military where it's like, got a job to do, go do the job, go back to your station or wherever you know, live and wait for the next one, you know, go get that one. And these very like tough people who fight fire. And I think it gets overlooked that everybody in the fire community is running on next to no sleep. You know, it's very stressful. You know, that, I thought you did a good job too of painting that picture in your book Lookout about the long hours, the like oven like temperatures in your tower. I mean, that was nuts. So it,
yeah, like those long hot days, like they really do start to like stack up, and you definitely start to feel a little haggard version of yourself for sure.
I bet. Yeah. I mean, it's got to weigh on you. And then, you know, like a storm comes over, so you're not getting a full night's sleep sometimes, probably if that storm hits the middle of the night. And, you know, a lot of things that go into it that I think people, when they see the romantic version of a lookout, they're thinking like, oh, it's kind of like a cabin up in this remote area and get away and, you know, like do some cool projects, you know, have a pet squirrel, you know, and then it's like,
yeah,
there's a lot
totally.
To it.
Yeah, no, for sure. Like the gal I spoke with yesterday when she was asking, like, what do you do out there? And I was like, well, like, I think people do think like, oh, you get bored out there. But like, I always just felt busy. And sometimes if the fire season was busy, you don't even really have a lot of time to focus on your hobbies because you're just like, you know, you're managing a cabin, you're managing a site that is essentially an essential fire break, right?
Yeah.
And like last season, you're responsible for like mowing the lawn and keeping the grass short. And last season was pretty wild because like I did have a, you know, a lookout colleague who really, you know, he was like very anal retentive about his lawn. Like it was so trimmed all the time, you know?
Yeah.
But well, it's good that he did because his site actually burnt over and there, you know, wasn't as substantial damage. And they think it is owing to the fact that he like cut his lawn
yeah.
So, you know, diligently. So, I mean, like there was a lot to do, like, you know, and if you're up there for 10 hours, well, you climb down, what are you doing? You're doing meal prep for the next day. You don't have a cook, you know, there's no one cooking for you. So you got to like, you really have to manage yourself out there, and it does take a lot of time. So
yeah,
we weren't, as my lifer neighbor would always say, it's not a picnic out here. No, it definitely is not a picnic at the lookout.
No.
There are moments where it can feel that way, but it's, the days stack up and it's a real grind, and lookouts in Alberta don't make overtime. So,
yeah.
You know, you're getting your 7.25, whether or not you're on low or you're on extreme. So that's a tricky thing too.
Yeah. I didn't know that. That's nuts. Holy cow. Yeah. And that's what I was going to ask you about too, in the beginning, is that like, you know, part of that Lookout book club. So our next book is Smoke Chaser, and you talked about it a lot in your book. And then in this book, they talk about it quite a bit about the, burnout rate and like, kind of like you mentioned the solitude part, I guess it gets to people. And I can't remember what the time frame they were saying in this older book. It took place in like the 1940s. But they were talking about like a lot of these younger folks who come out to do the lookout tower or fire, and they get posted in the lookout, they maybe last a week or two because they just can't control their mind or something. So they just start, you know, getting restless and stir crazy, and they eventually just come down and, you know, like don't last and go home. And so like, did you feel that at all, I guess?
No, I think, I mean, for me, I remember the first summer I really took it upon myself as like this challenge, like, you know, like a psychological challenge. Could I endure 4 months of isolation? Like, could I do it? And, I think I really wanted to do it. Like, I wanted to succeed at it. So yeah. Even when the moments were difficult, like I sort of pushed through them. And it's funny, as the seasons went on, like the isolation didn't bother me as much. Like I felt maybe I was just like accustomed to being able to manage it. And so it didn't feel as like physically intense as it did in like the first couple of seasons. I definitely got better at being alone. But I think also some people are just more cut out for it than others. Like I tend to be a little bit more introverted, or like I always thought I was really an extroverted person. And it turns out like I have very introverted hobbies, like writing and, you know, like pottery, and I really love the space and the time. And now that I'm not working as a lookout, I kind of struggle with that sometimes, where I'm like, oh, I feel like I don't have the same time that I used to have just to think and process things, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I don't know. I think you just like, it's like any other challenge. Like, I'm a really task-oriented person, so I would make lists. Just like if you did feel your mind slipping a little bit, you had to just like find ways to distract yourself and keep yourself sort of on task. Or, you know, or like my one tower friend Tori, she'd always be like, you know, you gotta do something, you gotta take care of your body, do exercise, feed your body, make sure you're eating healthy, getting enough sleep, and then like do something for your mind, so is it like reading a book or talking with a friend on the phone, like something to stimulate yourself intellectually, and then something like even spiritually too, right? Like, so like, yeah. How do you just really had to like, you know, and the way it was like every day was survival out there. It was like, you really got to just like make sure you're taking care of yourself. And that keeps you on track, I think, through the isolation. But for some people too, let's be honest, like some people just love it. Like,
yeah.
Like they would much rather be alone in the bush for 4 or 5 months than, you know, be in society. So it's I think it just really depends on the individual.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's another reason, you know, folks check out your book, because you touch on that a little bit too. And I'm not trying to give away too much of your book, so just a little teaser so folks go grab it for themselves and get a chance to read it. But like a book like yours, or any book that, you know, suits your fancy, like maybe you're trying to get into gardening and you want a how-to book on that, like you said, bring it with you. And especially as fire folks, like I'd always shove one in my pack, you know, like a not the hard copy, like the soft copy, is that right? You know, something that would like fold around my fire gear and throw it in my pack. And then, so on those, you know, when, if we ever did get a break, like if we were just, you know, sitting at a jump base somewhere, a spike base or something, and had some downtime, like we got smoked in McGrath for, I think, over 2 weeks in McGrath, Alaska. And so I just, you know, grabbed a book, because nothing else you can do. I mean, we could barely even see the runway from the little jump shack that we were hanging out in. So if you guys were watching a movie, and I just sat on the deck and just enjoyed a few good books and helped pass the time. And, I just, you know, you just feel better, I think, after immersing in a book, because it gives your brain something to do, you know?
Totally. Yeah, I would love, like, after Lookout came out, like, I would get sometimes messages from folks on crews, and they'd be like, hey, like, actually this one crew told me that they were on a fire and an export, and it ended up like raining a lot, so they were like cold and intense, you know, camping on the front line of a fire that's like dead anyways. And yeah. But they said they would read my book out loud like to one another at night, and I love that. I even sent a photo. I was like, that's a really cool feeling, knowing like, you know, your stories and your words are like finding, you know, this crew on the fire line. And I just like love the idea of the paperback book being like in someone's backpack, and, you know, just like, you know, kind of getting like stuff spilled on it, and yeah. Like pages torn, and like just like this worn book that gets passed around. Like that's why I write, you know, like,
yeah,
that's and that's always what's appealed to me about fire, because it's like fire folk just love telling stories. So like these stories get passed down, you know, from crews or from lookout to lookout. And like, so it's really special, I think, to be able, like, there's so many great fire books out there. And it's like, I feel really proud of Lookout, because it was a cool time of my life. And I love that it's just like one story in this sort of like ocean of very many stories about fire and like what binds us to the lifestyle. And Yeah,
totally.
And in that aspect, it is very romantic.
It is. Yeah. Oh, for sure. That was a great description, Trina. I mean, like, I couldn't imagine what the feeling would be like for you if you stumble across your book in, like, a random Forest Service cabin or, you know, lookout tower somewhere, and it was, like you said, all beat up because it had been passed around, smells like smoke and coffee. That would be a great feeling, I imagine.
Yeah, I think so. And I think why, you know, like, fire folk love reading about this, it's because, like, we can see ourselves in the stories, right? And
and maybe
that's part of it. It's like, we don't always feel that way when this, you know, we get our termination letter and we go off into the off season. It's like, okay, now what? But you know, like, I think people like being able to, like, see themselves reflected in the pages of something, you know, or whether it's like a movie you see yourself in. Although I don't know if people ever saw that Angelina Jolie movie about her being a lookout, but, like, I remember I watched it with another lookout at the end of, she hiked out to my tower after her tower closed, and we watched it, and we just, like, died of laughter because we were like, A, she was never even in the fire tower, although that would not really make, like, you know, a great, exciting movie as it was.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no.
I know.
We totally laughed.
I know, like, I still gotta watch it, but, like, that one scene where she's, like, climbing up the ladder with her gear is, like, whew, that'd be a tough tower to access. You gotta climb a ladder every day, you know, like, for the living one, you know what I'm saying? Like, because it was wasn't it a big tower like we have down here that you, like, live in?
Yeah, it did seem like she had to, like, climb a ladder to get up, and then there was this, like, hilarious moment where I think, like lightning struck the tower, and she, like, I don't know, or she got struck by lightning or something. I don't know. It's just, like, it was too much, you know. It's like, yeah. I was like, oh, okay.
That's what I was, cause, you know, I was aware of your guys' cabin or towers, because, I mean, you guys got some giant towers that are, you know, you access by a ladder, but, you know, and it's still, I mean, this is a lot for you guys to go up and down every day, but, like, for you to have, like, one of those, you know, like, I'm trying to think what I think they're L4s and R1s, we call them down here. They're like a little cabin on stilts that usually have stairs that you go up to them because you live in it. So you got to bring up food and water and everything else. And because, you know, we don't have, like, cabins on a lot of ours. You just live in the tower. And I was like, how does she get supplies up into that thing? You know?
Yeah. I was really curious about it too. And I'm definitely not as familiar as the US setup. But yeah, Yeah, that was a funny representation of the fire tower. And then there's this video game that people will reference a lot to. It's called Firewatch. I don't know. Have you heard of this?
No, I haven't.
And it's hilarious. So, like, my one, you know, like, some of my neighbors were gamers and stuff, or, like, my tower neighbors, I should say.
Yeah.
And this one guy, I remember, he played it, and he's like, yeah, it was all right. He's like, it wasn't very accurate, though, because you're never in the tower. And I was like, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
People love the idea of the story of the fire tower, but in reality, like, you know, it's like you spend a lot of time up there just looking. Like, that's what you do. You look for smoke, you know. That's the game. It's not like solving some mystery that happened around your tower or whatever.
But,
yeah. Representations of lookout can be really amusing for sure.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I'm trying to make it, like, entertaining. And that's what I think was really another thing that was really great about your book, is that you didn't, like, stretch anything. It was just the experience, and it was still entertaining and, like, a real page turner, as you heard from our whole book club. It was like, man, people just flew through it versus, like, I get it, you know, some people, some of the books out there too that I've heard of that I haven't got around to reading yet, and, you know, like the movie, like Angelina Jolie movie, I get it. I gotta, like, remind myself, like, all right, it's not really for us fire folks, you know. They're just trying to captivate a different kind of audience than just using some,
totally, yeah.
So I gotta, like, keep reminding myself, especially like fire books. But, like, with yours, I didn't have to, though. It was like, man, this is just her doing her thing. And the one thing is, you said, I think about, like, finding that new challenge, because that's what, for me, as just in my life, I found, like, best to whenever I'm kind of completing something, to find that next mission, the new challenge, like you said. Like, even, I mean, graduating, like, high school or something, if you don't have something next to go for, I think it could be kind of tough, because I took a year off between college and high school, and I was like, I remember I felt like I was just kind of floating around, and I was working, but it wasn't really fulfilling. And then I got into college, and then the next challenge was college track and trying to make the team, and then I made the team, and then I was just getting my ass kicked by all these, like, super college athletes, and because I'd taken a year off and hadn't really trained, so, like, I had to train my butt off to even compete, you know. And then that was a slow process to catch up, and then after that, you know, is the fire community, you know, you just get into wildland fire and then smoke jumping. And now, like, this is the new challenge here with the podcast. So I guess I kind of feel that new challenge thing. Is that kind of what you were mentioning earlier, I guess?
Yeah, like, I mean, I think for being a writer, like, I love writing books, and I, like, that's a great point. Like, it is really nice to have something that you're working on or some sort of goal or something that sort of feeds your spirit, I think.
Yeah.
And I'm really lucky to have that, like, being able to write books. Like, I just wrapped up a book that actually took me back to the fire tower, and it's a book about, it's going to be coming out in spring 2025. It's called Black Bear. And it's about my, the second fire tower I worked at for 4 years was really in this, like, incredible Black Bear corridor. And the previous lookout had been there for 10 years. And there was sort of, like, folklore stories of him and the bears, you know, like, you know, and like, certainly, like, when I got there, I was like, whoa, yeah, like, these bears are, like, really not afraid of people, you know? And, like, so how do I live with them? And the first year was really, like, there were some precarious moments for sure that involved a shotgun and rubber bullets and, you know, and but I think I kind of made peace with those bears over the 4 years I was there, and then really, you know, kind of enjoyed watching them. So I've been working on this book for, like, over the winter, and it's been a really cool focus, and it's been fun because it's kind of taken me back to the fire tower and a lot of those memories.
So
in some ways it does feel like a little bit of a continuation of Lookout. Like, people tease me, they're like, oh, you should write a sequel, and I was like, no, never. But in a weird way, it sort of is. It's just a different perspective at the Lookout, because it's not as focused on wildfire, and it's more focused on, like, well, how do you negotiate space with, like, you know, 500 pound dominant male black bear, you know, in breeding season.
Yeah.
So,
oh, absolutely.
Those are definitely parts of being out at the Lookout, depending on, you know, like, some lookouts, like, you know, get more wildlife than others, but this one definitely was considered, like, a bear tower for sure. So I learned a lot. I learned a lot from those bears, actually.
I bet. Yeah. Learn how to, like, coexist. Like, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's cool. It's a really, you know, unique thing. I don't know if I'll ever have that kind of experience ever again in my life. Like, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's very cool. And I think I'm glad you're writing another book, because, you know, and you kind of touched on that tower a little bit at the end of your book, Lookout. But it's cool that you're, you know, writing more, because I think for folks who hopefully read your first, you know, your first Lookout book, will read this one and get to know that there's, you know, it's... there's a different world out there from tower to tower or from year to year. You know, you're never getting the same thing. And I think it's like we'd mentioned it before I hit record, is the, you know, like, for me, I kind of have this, like, restless nature and, you know, don't like a repetitive, I guess, and, like, routine. So fire was always attractive to me, because, like, it doesn't even matter if you're working in the same district, same crew, smoke jumping, same lookout tower, it's going to be a different year. You know, nothing's the same ever, you know, like, there'll be some similarities, but the weather's always different, the fire season's always different, experiences, you know, new things happen every year, and I think that's really cool that you write another book.
Yeah, it's so true. Like, yeah, every season is a little bit different, hey, and there's different challenges, different people, different weather, different fire circumstances, like, even at the Lookout, too, like, you know, it's I remember someone in my third season sort of said to me, like, well, don't you feel kind of, like, bored with it now? Like, you know how to do the job. And it's like, yeah, but you can think that. But then when you're out there in reality, like, something happens that you didn't see coming. And yeah, the bear, for me, the bears were a big part of that, where it was like, okay, so, like, how do I do my job watching for smoke? And then also I have to be, like, keeping a close eye down below on my dogs and, like, these bears that are coming, like, pretty close, in close proximity and stuff. So that was, like, a new thing for me to manage and figure out, you know, and inevitably sort of, like, learned how to live with them through trial and error, really. Like, just like a relationship with a person, really. I think that's what I realized, is I was like, wow, like, they're just as, like, they're such a sentient animal that really, I think they pick up on intent. I think they can, like, sense, you know, how your stress levels. I think,
yeah,
like,
I think so.
They're so intuitive. And really, I think once I realized that and started to respect them as, you know, not just like a pest that I had to deal with, but as, like, oh, like, this bear lives here, you know, and, like, this bear probably knows a lot about me, actually. Like, I started to respect them on a different level, and I think that's when, like, the relationship with them started to improve.
Yeah, totally. That's going to be true.
Yeah, it was,
oh, go ahead.
It was just really cool. Oh, sorry?
Oh, I said go ahead. I was going to cut you off, and I was, you know, but, it, you know, my bad. I was just going to say that, you know, like you said, it's kind of similar to humans. I'm like, yeah, you gotta set up boundaries. You know, like with the
totally bear. yeah it was all about boundaries. Yeah, that's like one chapter in the book is called boundaries.
Oh, awesome. That's very cool.
Yeah but no, I'm excited to share that book with people, and it's been really fun to work on this over the last winter, and yeah, I mean, I think it's like, you know I think I could there's probably even another book in me about Fire Tower and Lookout and stuff. Like, I think it's and I don't necessarily know if I'm going to write that book, but it's like, it's just, it's a big part of my life. And like, even just listen to us now, you know, like both they kind of jiving off of each other on, in terms of fire stories, like it's just a special community to be a part of. And,
Totally.
Yeah.
I was going to
say,
so many stories. And then like, you know, for me selfishly, I hope you write another one, but because for me, it's also a vehicle for me to relive some fire stuff, not really through like, not my stories, but like your stories, and like, get to kind of put myself in your shoes, but I get a little taste of the fire world, you know, in a different place too. And I'm like, oh, this is super cool.
It is. Yeah. It's really neat, to be able to like, to make connections with folks across the border too. And I sort of wonder if like, you know, as with climate change and as wildfires continue to intensify, like the relationships between, you know, like, North American crews and lookouts and, across border will become even more sort of poignant, because relying on, well, like, look at how many American hotshot crews came up to Canada last season, right? So it's kind of a cool opportunity to learn about how, you know, people do things a little bit differently in different places. And
totally,
yeah, all we have, the things we have to learn from one another. And it was really cool for me to join the book club the other week, because I just also realized too, I was like, wow, like, you know, when we're talking about like technology and even like internet at the lookout, so like Alberta's really privileged in this system of like, you know, having Wi-Fi and like, you know, like just like having like pretty fast internet and stuff. And like, and then talking to some of the lookouts down in the States that like don't have that same technology and stuff. And it's like, wow, like that's the real deal. Like that's like, that would just intensify the isolation and some of the challenges of the job. So
yeah, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. I think someone like in the Bob Marshall Wilderness, which is just a little bit north of where I'm at, I want to say, I don't think a lot of those folks have any kind of cell phone service, so it's all radio contact with the outside. It's, yeah, pretty wild, pretty interesting. And I kind of want to check that out one day. That's kind of my retirement plan, is to try to staff a lookout up in the Bob Marshall Wilderness or somewhere remote, you know.
Yeah, that's a real deal. I have a lot of respect for that. And maybe they prefer it that way too, you know, like it's, I know it is nice to be, I just went on a ski trip like last week, and it's like, it's really nice to be disconnected from the internet, you know, and I do think that allows you to like be a better lookout in some ways, because you're just like that much more immersed in like the physical world versus, you know, like looking at your phone and seeing what people are doing on social media and stuff. So yeah
I totally think so too. Yeah, like it feels like your sensitivity for your surroundings goes way up when you don't have a phone or something else to distract you, and you're just more, like you said, in the nature. And I think you're listening more, and you know, your sense of smell and all those things start to, you know, heighten a little bit.
The one of the rangers at the training that we got, I remember, for like becoming lookouts, and I'll never forget this story. He was talking about a gal, a lookout, who was out at the lookout, and she was like looking down at, I think, at an iPad or something, some screen device.
Yeah.
And she didn't even realize that she looked up and there was a bear right in front of her. And like, ooh, you know, the bear was probably just as curious. Like, what is this? What is this? What, you know,
yeah,
just
like, up to?
Just like ambled up to her and like sniffed her hand. And then she was like, holy fuck. Sorry to disbelieve, but she just like jumped back. And anyways, I think that just like goes to show, it's like, yeah, you can be out in nature, you can be one with nature, and you may not even realize that you're one with nature, right?
Yeah, nature comes to you.
Exactly, if you're disconnected or if you're distracted by your technology. But
yeah, absolutely. And then like one more writing thing that I almost forgot to ask you about was, I saw you post an article, I think it was titled Alberta is Burning, and I thought you wrote an article in there. Was that you?
Yeah, so I just wrote a feature for Alberta Views magazine, and they asked me, the editor asked me to take like sort of a solutions approach, which I thought was a bit refreshing.
Yeah.
And so he was like, you know, talk to a number of different experts, you know, whether that's like a mayor at the municipal level, or like an Indigenous wildfire expert, or, you know, like I spoke with Mike Flanagan, who of course is like, you know, he's like 40 years experience working as a wildfire scientist, and then firefighting crews and stuff, someone at the union. They spoke with all different sort of sectors of people of like, what could we do better to manage the situation? And that was really refreshing for me because people were really focused on solutions, you know, whether that's like, yeah, like, you know, like let's address the staffing crisis really of like, you know, in wildfire right now. And, you know, like the fact that our government made all of these cuts in the last like 4 or 5 years.
Oh, man.
So that's one thing. And then another thing too is looking at sort of the forestry industry and like, you know, we know that like lightning does like to strike. They say lightning doesn't strike the same place. Well, that's not true. Like there are areas in topography where lightning is more common.
Yeah.
So what tree species are we planting there? You know, like one forester was saying, well, we should be planting more hardwood species, like deciduous, versus, you know, the fast burning coniferous, those pyrogenic trees.
Yeah.
So it was just really interesting and refreshing to hear solutions from people. And so that story is going to hit newsstands April 1st, and it'll be available online in April as well. So curious to hear people's thoughts on it.
Yeah, I can't wait to check it out because, like you said, it feels like in anything where you have like a big problem, it feels like you just hear more problems. And I got lucky to work for one of my friends who was a really good leader when I was younger, and he's like, I don't want to hear any more problems. I want to hear solutions. Like, what can we do about this? And I was like, I like that, you know. And then my brain kind of always switched over to that ever since, you know. It's like, yeah, I realized we got an issue here. Like, well, how are we going to fix it, you know?
Totally. Yeah. And I think like what occurred to me as I was listening to people for this story, like doing the research, is that like everybody has a role to play. It's not just on government. It's not just on firefighters. It's not just on fire agencies. Like it's on individuals too, like fire smarting around your home. Like that's not mandatory in most places, but it really can make a big difference, of course, in, you know, preventing the spread. And so, yeah, fire smarting, having like, you know, a bug out bag or an emergency plan. Like what if a wildfire comes to your community? Where are you going to go? What are you going to do? You know, like that's not just on government. That's like also on you having a plan in place. And I think the average person doesn't. Or even just like thinking of the design in neighborhoods. Like one guy was like, you know, he's like, think about how like access points in and out of neighborhoods and communities, like,
yeah,
you know, you get these like bottlenecks, right? Because there's only so many escape points. And so things like this, I think, really need to be brought into, like, let's just be honest, like we live in a pyrogenic state, you know, and fires will continue to get closer and closer to communities, just also because communities are expanding more into, you know, areas where fire exists. So it's like, you know, like it's just like we're such a reactive species, right? Like stuff, crisis happens and we respond and then we just kind of forget. And it's like, hey, we really need to like build this into our reality, even just on an individual level. Like, what does it mean to live in a fire state, right? Like,
totally.
And we're all responsible to a certain extent. So, yeah.
No, and I that's well put. And I talked with a bunch of fire folks a couple years ago and I was like, we finally started doing more of a fuel push of like thinning and trying to figure out more fuel breaks, like you said, and like you said, helping people with their own homes, like, because like you said, that could be a fuel break too. Like the fire stopped at your house because you reduced the fire fuel around your house. Like that helps us a lot and keeps your house, you know, so all these good things. So we'd always be like, let's be proactive instead of reactive. You know, we've been reactive for so many years in fire. Let's try to do something before, like more preventative and stay ahead of it. And like you said, like, plan our communities with fire in mind, because like you said, it's not going anywhere, you know, especially in Canada, here in the Northwest and Southwest, really in the US, you know. So it's like, let's do better planning, and I think we'll be in better shape and, you know, get better roads, because there was a tragedy fire and there's probably been a few where folks, families trying to flee and were too late to get out of there, got stuck in the flame front, and you know, I think a few family members perished in that, you know, died in that fire, and it's just a like unavoidable tragedy. And you're like, man, what happened there?
You know? Exactly. yeah, like we can't, you know, like there's certain things that are out of our hands for sure, and like acts of Mother Nature and stuff, but there's a lot that we can do to be better prepared, I think. And you know, and it should, you know, a lot of folks I spoke to for the story said the problem is it's because we're so reactive. It's like people talk about this stuff right when it's happening, and then for the rest of the months of the year, it's sort of, you know, the funding runs out, or people are just like, it's not put as a priority. So, I mean, we really need to get ahead of fire. And I mean, I guess like my only hope is like out of a devastating fire season, like it was in Alberta last, and many places last summer, like that really, it can, you know, like quote unquote, light a fire under people's butts to be like, okay, we do need to prioritize this 12 months of the year, you know, like not just,
totally.
Not just when it's happening, but
yeah, not just in August. Yeah, when things are, you know, ripping, you know, in the rest of the year, when especially when it's, you know, snowing and things are, you know, like when there's no fire out there, it's like, that's the time, you know, plan. And then once spring hits, put the plan into action when you can access those areas, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And just like the public getting on board, I think, with more like prescribed burns and like, you know, accepting that some smoke and some fire is actually really good and healthy versus, you know, like, you know, being able to like to prepare around communities and stuff and, or create those sort of fire breaks or, yeah, like just getting people on the public on board to, cause you know, it's like, and I saw just on social media a couple of days ago, someone posted a photo of it was a prescribed burn and they were sort of, it was this alarmist image. Right.
Yeah.
And then of course someone down in the comment was like, no, that was a prescribed fire. Right. So like the public also needs to be educated, I think, in terms of what is good fire and what is actually dangerous fire.
But
that can be, that's a whole other conversation.
Oh, totally. Yeah. We get to go down for a while, but yeah, like if we can get the public to be on board with more of that and see that there's a healthy, you know, people are posting pictures, but I think you can never get enough information on it. But like pre-prescribed fire, post-prescribed fire, and you get to see like this lush green grass growing back up and the forest isn't so cluttered with all the dead and down, like around my hometown of Whitehall. It's lodgepole, so the stuff just falls over all the time, and so it's all jack strawed around there, you know, all stacked on top of each other. Not even animals want to go in there, so it's like, and it's a lot of fuel on the ground right now for if a fire gets anywhere east of Butte, you know, it's gonna be pretty hard to manage. So it's like, if we were doing prescribed fire on that this whole time, it wouldn't be that way. It'd be a lot better for us, for all of us and for all the animals and anybody else who wants to venture out there, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Healthier, I guess, too. Well, one last question before I let you go, if you got time for it.
Yeah, you bet.
Sweet. Are you a coffee drinker?
Well, it's funny you ask me that. I used to be a coffee drinker. I drink a lot of coffee at that lookout for sure. And I've just like the last 3 months I've been trying to wean myself off of it. So I've started drinking green matcha tea instead, which like the caffeine doesn't give me quite as crazy a buzz.
yeah like matcha is more of like a almost like a slow release, right? It's like a little more smoother caffeine, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like it doesn't hit me quite the same way, although it's hilarious because yesterday I did actually make an espresso, like a stovetop espresso.
Yeah.
And it was so delicious. Like I love the taste of coffee so much.
Yeah.
And that little hit, that buzz, you just feel like so hyper focused. But then I felt a huge crash in the evening, so I was like scolding myself this morning, and I was like, Trina, you're not having coffee today. You're going to do your green matcha. So
I think I got to make the switch too, because like even, you know, with my guts, you know, they don't seem to like coffee too much. So I go pretty easy on it. But I was just curious because, you know, coffee is such a big part of the wildfire scene and probably fire in general. But is there like a special way you'd make it? Is there like a roast? Would you prefer like a light roast?
Well, when I was at the lookout, my favorite was like I had one of those little camp AeroPresses.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with those?
Oh yeah, I AeroPressed this morning.
Oh yeah, I love my AeroPress. And like, it was a gift. I remember in one off season, I worked at a coffee shop in Peace River, and the owners gifted me this like Aero. He's like, "Oh, you gotta have an AeroPress." It's like, you know, I think like it's even printed on the box, like best cup of coffee in the world or something like outrageous like that, right?
Yeah.
And so he gifted me with that. So yeah, I would usually do like a dark roast Kicking Horse coffee. I think it's called like Kick Ass. Canadians will know what I'm talking about with that.
Yeah.
and yeah, and I'd grind that up in the morning, and then I'd have my AeroPress, and yeah, a little bit of just a little bit of cream, and it just, like, man, I love coffee. Yeah, and I loved, like, just sort of the, you know, like I was that lookout that when crews would land at my tower, I'd have coffee ready to go in a big thermos, and maybe like a scone or a cookie or something. And, just like such a social part of fire, as you say.
It's huge. Yeah, that's what I was asking, because not really so much from a smoke jump, but we just make like cowboy coffee in this big, like, looks like a paint can. And, you know, a lot of times you're eating some of the grounds or a lot of the grounds, depending on where you're at on the line of getting the paint can poured into your cup. But I got picked up on the AeroPress years ago. And when I first got the experience of the AeroPress, it's a little bit of a slow process, right? And I was used to like a drip pour over coffee maker. It was pretty quick. And so I was like, I didn't really have the patience for it. It was really early and I was really tired. And my friend Charlie Palermo was doing all the steps, hand grinding. And then, you know, I had that little stir stick to stir it up before you press it out. And I'm just like losing my patience, you know. And then I tasted it. I was like, wow, this is incredible. So then I started bringing that. And especially when I was on an engine, then, like you said, like the social part of it, anybody who came by and was like, if we take a break in the afternoon or something, you know, an afternoon cup after lunch, it'll pick me up. It's like, hey, you know, we want coffee? And it's actually pretty quick once you get it down. And, you know, we just press out whoever, you know, wanted some coffee and share a little coffee and catch up and talk a little shop about the fire and then get back after it. It's just such a nice ritual as part of fire, you know?
Yeah, I love that word ritual. And, like, that's how I felt at the lookout, too, is, like, the first thing I do, you know, you get up, you look out the cabin, make sure there's no bears around, and, like, you know, go let the dogs out for a pee, and then I'd, like, boil water for that AeroPress coffee, and, you know, and, like, honestly, I actually almost feel, like, teary thinking about it. Like, it was just a beautiful way to start the day. Like, you know, you didn't know what kind of day it was going to be, if it was going to be a crazy day or what, but I called it my sacred hour, where you just, like, it wasn't even an hour, you know, like, maybe it'd be, like, 10 minutes, or just, like, sit outside on your front stoop and you listen to the birds in the forest. And, you know, it's like all the romance that someone imagines about the fire tower just condensed in those 10 minutes sitting on the front stoop with your coffee. And, like, oh yeah, like that's, you know, and then just like knowing you're part of this legacy of like other lookouts sitting on their front stoop with coffee, you know, for like in Canada, I mean, for like, you know, almost a century. So it's a cool part. It's a thinking of the coffee actually brings me back to that memory. So I'm really glad you asked me. It's a cool question.
Yeah. Oh, thanks. Yeah. Cause I'm glad you feel the same way. Cause I'm the same, you know, like, you know, when just talking about AeroPresses brings me back to that fire in Eastern Montana. And like you said, the morning ritual and my friend, Charlie Palermo with his hand grinder, you know, as a sound of like, that would typically wake a lot of the folks up, was just that, you know, grinding away and then the smell and just that, like a little bit of chill before the day gets rolling, you know?
Totally. I love that. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. Such good times. Well, Trina, thank you so much for spending your morning with me. I really appreciate it. Took me a while to figure out how to do this, but I think we got her. And then I wanted to.
Yeah. Thanks so much. It was a really great conversation. It's so fun to sort of spitball with you and obviously talk about something we both really care about. So yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Like, and then that kind of brings up one last point is that when you were talking about, you know, the community and fire, like for folks who are listening, we've never met each other, like, except for a book club meeting that was like a bunch of us on a Zoom call. And we were all just kind of talking about little pieces of your book and then about our experiences in fire and lookouts and stuff. So it's like not that intimate, you know, but it's a cool time because we all get to like share something about, you know, lookouts in your book that we all enjoy. But like we've never actually like talked long form. So it's pretty cool that we can get together over this and have this great conversation and hear, you know, all the stuff that you're up to and been doing, and then this article, you know, because otherwise I would probably maybe tracked it down, but like, you know, life gets so busy, I might not have tracked this article down, but now talking about it, I'm like, April 1st, I'll be waiting on this article to hit, you know, because I definitely want to see what it's about, you know?
Yeah, well, I certainly appreciate it. It's cool. We can make these connections and yeah, and who knows, hopefully I really hope this conversation finds some people out to guys and gals on the fire line or up in the lookout this summer. So the timing is really cool. So yeah, thanks again for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much, Trina. And yeah, I've heard from a few folks, especially, you know, like a lot of driving in fire. So like with the crews around here in the States, and so that a few of my friends will blast it on for the whole group and in the buggy or in the truck. So I hope a lot of people get to listen to it and then pick up your book, and I hope they're as excited about the next one as I am with the Black Bear, right?
Yeah. I'll be updating about that on my Instagram page. And if people want to reach out to me, it's always really cool to hear from readers and stuff, and hear little stories or get little photos of people like out, you know, in there doing what they do in the fire world. So yeah, it's great when people reach out to me.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, like I think I just Googled you at first, and I saw like, you know, your picture with your book with Lookout in the Tower, and then a bunch of other folks kind of doing similar photos. I was like, oh, that's very cool.
Yeah, it's neat. It's neat to see the books kind of show up in different places. Like I've gotten photos of like the book at like old lookouts, or yeah, like with folks on the fire line or like in the tent. Like that was that one crew that was like reading the book out loud on that kind of miserable export. It sounded like it kind of added a little, like, you know, it was just like a nice part of their day and their crew ritual. So that was cool to be a part of. So,
oh, so cool.
Yeah, I know. Thanks to everybody for reading and reaching out. I always really appreciate that.
Yeah. Thanks to everyone who's tuned into this and listening. And then one last thing, if folks want to check out your social media, where do they go, I guess?
My Instagram is Trina Rianne Moyles. And I'm pretty much mostly only active on Instagram. So that's the best way to find me. And just forewarned now, I don't post pictures of the lookout. I mostly post pictures of my two tower dogs and pottery but I still get out and hike and stuff quite a bit. So I've like a pretty nature, still post a lot about being out in the woods for sure.
Yeah, it's been great for me following along with you and the ski trips, and some of your photography is incredible of, you know, the place you've been out in the woods, and then, you know, some of the stories come out in your lookout book, and I imagine be the same way with Black Bear. Really looking forward to it. And thank you so much, Trina, for joining me, and maybe we'll have a follow-up one down the road if you're game.
Yeah, sounds good. Thank you again.
Alrighty, have a great day, Trina. Talk to you soon.
Okay, take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye.